The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled Jewry in Exile, is the first of a 15-part series, From the Exile of the Ten Tribes to the Reign of Herod. This lecture was originally given at Machon LaTorah, the Jewish Learning Network of Michigan, and is dedicated to the memory and Le'ilui Nishmas Mordechai ben Manas Olav HaSholom, Mr. Marvin Scher of blessed memory.
One of the great curiosities of history is the fate of the ten lost tribes. What actually did happen to them? Did they eventually intermarry and assimilate with their neighbors, as was the fate of Spanish Jewry some 500 years ago, or Chinese Jewry some 300 years ago? Or did they eventually migrate and merge with the corpus of Jewry? Is it possible that many of us in this room tonight are actually descendants of those ten tribes? Or perhaps they're living in some isolated area of this globe, waiting to hear the call of the great shofar, the time of Mashiach, and come back to Eretz Yisroel. Where is the location of the mysterious river Sambatyon, the river that rests on Shabbos? Is it possible that there's truth to the story that there are Jews that live on the other side? What is the status of the Falashas, or the Beta Yisroel? Those group of Ethiopians, virtually indistinguishable from their neighbors, yet clinging steadfastly to their Jewishness. This and much, much more will be covered tonight. But first, I'd like to address a question that goes beyond the oddities of history and touches the very heart of our inquiries. What crime or crimes did these people perpetrate? The ten tribes should fall into the oblivion of history, and the rest should be subject to discrimination, persecution, and expulsion up to this day. In order to answer that question, it'd be important for us, first of all, to focus on what is the backdrop of much of our history, especially the period that we'll be discussing in this series, Eretz Yisrael. I would like the slide projector. You've been provided with an outline and a map at the end. You'll find it on the top left-hand corner. Eretz Yisrael of antiquity was perhaps the most strategic land amongst all the civilizations. Its coast and its harbors straddled the East Mediterranean, you see. Its roads connected the empire of Africa, Egypt, Libya, Ethiopia, with the empires of Asia Minor, of Syria, of Mesopotamia, Assyria, and Babylon. In fact, the prophet calls Eretz Yisrael, says Tabor Haaretz. It's the midpoint. It's the nexus of civilization. But besides its location We find the stress of its unrivaled beauty, its lushness, the arid Zovos Chol V'Dvash, the land flowing with milk and honey, a land that the Torah describes as Loisechzer Kolbo, lacking nothing. And it's understandable, as the prophet Yechezkel says, it was Tzvi L'chol Arotzos, it was the envy of all nations. And the history of Israel during the period is a history of conquest and counter-conquest. Because this area, the Tzvi L'chol Arotzos, was a land that knew very little peace. In fact, according to the Sifri, the halachic midrash on Parsha Zois HaBrocha, when the Jews left Egypt, in the second slide, when the Jews left Egypt, the towns that were populated, the 31 kings, and these are all the towns, you'll find them in your map in the back. This is on your lower right-hand corner. Were actually colonies of great world powers. Just as Africa and China had spheres of influence in the late 19th century, so too the Eretz Yisrael, the Israel that the Jews found on their way from Egypt, was actually a conquered land. And every city represented a colony or a palatial home of some great world power. So in fact, the war of conquest was not just a war against local chieftains, but actually was the First World War. And since that original conquest, the Jews knew very little peace. But the war was not just on a political or military front. It was a war on an ideological front. And it was a question of the ideology of the Torah, or the pure vision of monotheism, with the paganism and the sensuousness of their neighbors. And much of the history that's recorded in the book of Judges, later on in the book of Kings, is our victories and defeats against that war. And we find time and again, when the prophets were reproaching the Jews, the major theme was idolatry. What that idolatry was, what that theology was, what would that appeal, we'll leave to another lecture, the lecture dealing with the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah at the time when idolatry came to a close. But I'd like to deal now in terms of numbers. How many Jews were involved? How many idol worshippers were there? And it's important for us to realize, in the analysis of the history of the period, that when we read a passage from the prophets, and they give some very sharp rebuke about the Jews, that they've done this or they've done that, historically, it's very difficult to have any idea in terms of hard numbers. And I'd like to give you a few examples. In the original conquest, the first city that was conquered was the city of Jericho, Jericho. As it's described, the walls literally sunk into the ground. Every inhabitant was killed. And all objects of value were dedicated to the temple. One individual by the name of Ochon, you found this in your outline, stole from the city of Jericho a few items. On the next major campaign against the city of Ai, the troop that the Jews sent out were routed with casualties. And when Joshua complained what had happened, the reply that was given to him says, as you've seen your outline, is Chotei Yisrael. The Jews have sinned. They've done terrible things. And when the story is revealed, we find there's only one person who did this. Yet for that one person, all of Jewry are held accountable. Kol Yisrael Arevim Zebazev. That every Jew is accountable to what happens in the community. So that when the charges are leveled against the community, it's not necessarily the community has done anything as a community, but the fact that it was tolerated, or the society could breed such behavior, is the focus of the rebuke. We find another example. It's Shabbos. It's also in your outline. When the Jews first came to the desert, when the idea of Shabbos was introduced as a commandment, after they had started gathering the manna, the mon, and in Shabbos they were told that it wouldn't be any. And it's a sum of the, and it doesn't say numbers, some of the people went out to collect the manna. And again, Moshe Rabbeinu is rebuked. Hashem tells him, says, you're not listening to my mitzvahs. How long can you refuse to do my commandments? That was one incident. And it says afterwards, from that time on, there were no problems. There's a second incident that's recorded. And that's the incident of the Mekoshesh. One person left the camp, gathered wood. He was put to death. We know of no other desecration of Shabbos. Yet some 900 years later, the prophet Yechezkel, Ezekiel, when describing what the Jews had done when they left Egypt, the expression is, "V'gamas shabsoisai nosan lohem liyos ois beinu veinehem," I gave them Shabbos as a sign between them. "V'yimru bi beis Yisroel b'midbor," they rebelled against me. "V'shabsoisu chilu me'oid," and my Sabbaths they disgraced terribly. One incident. Two incidents. If we look today in America, at least, that only 10% of Jewry keep Shabbos, what would the prophet say to us? Intermarriage. After a trend that's been increasing, the latest figures in America show there's over 50% intermarriage. There was an intermarriage problem at the time when the Jews came back to rebuild the Second Temple. And again, the Ezra, says the leader of the Jews, stood up and says, "Atam altam," says, "You've sinned terribly." Says you're dwelling with strange women. It's a terrible thing. And they took action, and they made sure that all those who had intermarried would divorce their wives. The original population when they settled there was some 42,000. And it was increased through the years. We don't know the exact number. But all those who had intermarried was 114. And yet this was a national calamity. There's only one time that we have some idea, though, of figures. And that's the period of Ahav. Less than 100 years after the northern kingdom, Yisrael, had split from the southern kingdom, Yehuda, following the death of Solomon, Shlomo HaMelech, Ahav, who was married to a daughter of a foreign king, introduced the worship of Baal. The Ahav himself reigned for 22 years. At that During those years, he tried to suppress all his critics. They tried to kill the prophets who rebuked them. 2 years after his death, his son relaxed those edicts. He didn't ban the worship of Baal, but it was an alternate religion, and he tolerated it. After 12 years of his reign, this is 36 years total, that Baal had been introduced as the official, as a national religion. Yehu came up in a would be known the equivalent of a palace coup, destroyed the whole family of Ahav. And as you have in your notes, this is on page 6, this is note 6, and I'll read it to you. He had a plan, Yehu, to destroy all the worshippers of Baal. The Yikbutz Yehu's Kolom, he gathered all the people and said to them, "Whereas Ahav served Baal only a little, but I will serve him much." And he called all the worshippers of Baal, their prophets, their priests, and made sure that from the north and south of the land, from the length and the breadth, that no worshipper of Baal would be missing for this conclave. And he got them all into the temple of Baal. It was packed. You have to realize a temple then wasn't just a place for seats. It was a slaughterhouse. In the temple courtyard, there was a sanctuary. So it had people and animals, and the slaughterers were there already with their knives. And Yehu ordered his soldiers inside the temple. He put 80 soldiers around the perimeter of that temple to make sure no one escapes, and killed all the worshippers of Baal. And as the prophet says, the worship of Baal came to an end. How many people could fit in such a temple? There were 80 people outside with swords. There were no machine guns. Probably in the thousands. The last census that we know of in Yisrael, the northern kingdom, was at the time of David HaMelech. This is over 100 years before, 150 years before. At that time, there was 1,100,000 males that were eligible for military conscription. It's hard to know population growths over 150 years. I know over the last 50 years, the American population grew from 150 million to 250 million. The world population grew from some 3 billion to 5 billion. This is 50 years. So it's hard really to know how many people there were. But after Baal had been introduced as the national religion, evidently the vast majority of Jews clung stubbornly to their Jewishness. It just did not take hold. And if this is when it was sanctioned by the government, one probably has a sense of the numbers when it was illicit and it was illegal. So historically, when we deal with the ills of the period, we're not dealing so much with the numbers of how many criminals there were, sinners or backsliders. We're dealing with the level of toleration of the community. Now, it's akin to the famous story. Someone's on a ship, and he sees another person drilling a hole near his seat in the ship. And he comes over to him and says, "What are you doing?" "Well, I'm drilling a hole, can't you see? You know, we could all sink." He says, "Listen here, I don't tell you what to do on your end of the ship. Don't tell me what to do where I'm sitting." It's really that attitude seems to be the major criticism. But there was one sin that seems to have been, at least on some level, whether coerced or not coerced, seems to have been common as a whole to the kingdom of Yisrael. The next slide. Okay. There are three major institutions that kept the Jews in their diverse tribes as a national unit. There was the idea of a standard judiciary. In other words, there's a mitzvah, shoftim v'shoytrim titon l'cha, that in every city there were yeshivas, there were bote dinim, there were courthouses. There was a central court, a supreme court, and as a result, there was a standardization of practice. The doubts that we have in the practice of Jewish law were not a problem in this period. If there would be any doubt in a lower court, it would go and be resolved by a higher court. And in that sense, there was a national presence, so to speak, a standardization of life. Even though we do know that there was a difference in terms of the flavor of the different tribes, perhaps the dialect, the twang of the different tribes, but there was a standardization of practice. The second institution is the institution of the executive branch. In the first 28 years after the conquest, Yehoshua, so Joshua was the king. It was a strong executive branch. However, in the years following his death, after the central army had been retired, there wasn't really a strong executive. When there would be a problem, a citizen army would be called from time to time. The leaders were called shoftim. They weren't kings. They were judges. It was only in the time of the monarchy, some 400 years after the original conquest, that began to have a central government with a king, with taxes, with a standing army. But after the death of Shlomo, the death of Solomon, and when they were split between Yehuda in the south and Yisrael in the north, already we had, again, this break. But there's a third area which kept the Jews together, and that's the Beis HaMikdash. Because the Jews had to come together from the far ends of Eretz Yisrael, from the south and the north, and to come together in one central area. Three times a year, every Yontif, there was a sense of unity. There was a sense of inspiration. They all came to the Beis HaMikdash. The first, what we call the real Beis HaMikdash, was in Shiloh, which was in the area of the original, of the northern part in the ten tribes. Later, after the defeat of the Jews in battle, when the ark was taken, captured by the Philistines, and later returned, there was a hiatus of 57 years, where the original tabernacle was in use, but it didn't have that central function, at least to the extent that it originally had. According to Maimonides, the Jews still in this 57-year period, when the tabernacle was wandering, so to speak, first in Nov and then in Givon, still had to come together for Yontif three times a year. But there was a certain allowance of private worship. And this is the Boma. That one could offer his own sacrifice. One didn't have to go to the temple. Whereas when it was operative in Shiloh, the one was not allowed to worship privately, to bring a sacrifice. One would have to come to Shiloh. And later on, when the temple was built by Shlomo in Yerushalayim, again, they were not allowed to do it on their own. So there was a sense of what anything that has to be done has to be done together. But after the death of Shlomo, when the southern kingdom split, the northern kingdom, Rehoboam, Shlomo's son, was the king of the southern kingdom, but Yerovam, the son of Nevat, Yerovam ben Nevat, who had had the blessings based on the prophecy of Achia Shiloni, became the king of the northern kingdom. He felt, in order to secure his place and make sure that the Jews, because they have to come back to Yerushalayim to worship, because every 7 years they all coming together to hear Kriyas HaTorah from the king, which would be Rehoboam, the king of Yehuda, he felt that his monarchy, his rule was threatened. And he had to create some sort of a system, some sort of a rationale, because they all have the Sefer Torah. In the Torah itself, and this is in the on page 6, this is note 1. In the Torah itself, they realize that they cannot worship. They can't bring a korban on their own. He created, in a sense, a new theology. As the Radak explains, his reasoning was that since Yerushalayim was no longer the center of government, it had also, in the process, it no longer was a central area of Jewry as a whole. As it's described, as you see in your note 1, it says, Amokam asher yivchar Hashem. The place of worship is the place that Hashem has chosen, God has chosen. And he reasoned, well, since Shlomo's dynasty no longer had rule over all of Israel, and Yerushalayim was no longer the executive center of Israel, it no longer was the place that had been chosen. And at this point, he maintained that private worship is allowed. So he went on to create, based on that hanocha, based on that reasoning, an alternate to Yerushalayim. And what would be a quite ironic, quite cynical, his choice of a replacement of Yerushalayim and the Oron and the Kruvim, was the golden calf that the Jews had sinned and had fallen so tremendously in the desert. His reasoning, of course, was, well, the Jews worship the golden calf. But the golden calf does represent something very spiritual. And that was the idea that Aaron, this is after Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, had delayed. He stood on the mountain for 40 days, and according to their calculations, the 40 days had passed already, and they felt that perhaps he had died. And they wanted a replacement, some symbolic figure that in their minds would represent Hashem's, God's, intervention in our lives. And they chose the form of the calf. Later on, of course, the people just didn't look at that as a symbol of God's intervention, but they looked at it as a deity in itself. And this is the heir of Rav. This is the mixed multitude that came with Moses. Yerovam reasoned, well, the only problem was the mixed multitude, but the idea was a good idea, and we're going to use it again. And he constructed two golden calves, one in the south, in Beis El, and one in the north, in Don. And these golden calves would be centers of worship. And he went one step further after that and created even new holidays. Besides the holidays the Torah created, he created another holiday. So to give them a certain religious national sense as a substitute for what they were missing. During all the years, this is almost 250 years that the northern kingdom survived as an independent kingdom, these calves and this notion of private worship was part and parcel of the national character of Yisrael. So that even the kings that abolished the worship of Baal felt that this was necessary and even sanctioned to have this worship of the golden calves. We learn a very interesting lesson, though, in terms of communal responsibility, as when those calves were eventually removed. You have on page 8, we describe the series of events that eventually that this kingdom Yisrael became dismembered. The Assyrians, this was the beginning of the Assyrian Empire, eventually went down, took over Syria, and in its first foray, this is under the king, says Pekah ben Remaliahu, the Jewish king, they took all of Naphtali, this area in the Galilee, and exiled its inhabitants. Some 8 years later, they went a new foray and took over this whole eastern area, which is now Jordan, which was originally Jewish. These were the tribes of Reuven and Gad and half of the tribe of Manasseh, and exiled them. And finally, in the last, what was left, this area was finally taken away. In the first foray, when they took this area, the calf, the golden calf that was in Dan, was taken away. And the next foray, they went down and took the calf that was in Basel. So for the last 8 years, they no longer had these sanctuaries in which were functioning. The king then, Hoshea ben Ela, decided then to loosen what had been a boundary which is described in similar terms that we understand the wall that divided East Berlin and West Berlin. There were guards in this whole border between Yisrael and Yehuda. During the period from Yeravam ben Nevat, the first king, to Hoshea ben Ela, the last king. But in his last 8 years, there was no attraction anymore for the worship that had been the national form of worship for so many years. He took away the guards, and he allowed free exercise that they could come to Yerushalayim if they wanted. And in fact, we have recorded the idea that Chizkiyahu, and this is note 3 on page 8, the king at that time of the southern kingdom actually invited the people. Once the guards were removed, come together as a people, and we'll have the Korban Pesach, the Paschal Lamb, which evidently they had done separately till then. We'll do it together. And when he sent his emissaries, they were greeted with much derision. It had been so ingrained, the idea that Yerushalayim no longer had a special place, that the turnout, those people who went out from the northern kingdom to the southern kingdom, it seems was less than unanimous. And really, as you read in the note on page 3, he says, some men of Asher and Manasseh and of Zvulun humbled themselves and came to Yerushalayim. It would seem the sense is there was only a minority, most certainly not an overwhelming majority. It's interesting to note that in retrospect, when the prophet speaks about Hoshea, he's spoken of in terms that as a sinner, as a terrible person. And it would seem on the surface he did something so wonderful. He caused that the northern kingdom, southern kingdom, at least what was left, should come together and worship together. He removed the old guards. And yet he's held accountable because of his position of power. He was the king. He shouldn't have just allowed them to go, but have mandated that they must go. And on one hand, we have the idea of what power and the responsibilities of power are. Now, there's a related Gemara. There's a passage in the Talmud, the Gemara in Sukkah and Chof Tes, that says that the reason people of wealth, one of the possible reasons, where they fall on harder times, is because of the wealth they had and the power that went with it. They could have done so much good in the community. What they said carried so much clout, but they didn't use it. If they didn't use the gift, there was no reason to have it anymore, and it was taken away from them. That's the sense we have in the Midrashim about Hosea's role. And the Jews, as a whole, no longer had any excuses. Up until that time, they could have blamed it on what would be governmental policy. They didn't let us. But when it was relaxed, it seems that not enough numbers came. This is, and finally, the remnant of Yisroel was taken away in exile. What happened to these people? We originally dealt with three possible scenarios of what happened to these people. Did they intermarry? Did they merge together with the other Jews? Are they isolated in some undiscovered area of this planet? I'd like to go through each of these alternatives with you. There's a Gemara, there's a passage in the Talmud in Yevamos that deals with a very interesting scenario. We know Kedushin marriage is created by giving something of value. Today it's a ring, a man to a woman, and saying a special formula which indicates that the marriage is taking place. If a non-Jew does it, this marriage has no validity from a non-Jew to a Jew. But what happens if we have a question, maybe this non-Jew is really a descendant of Jews, doesn't realize it? I mean, this could be a distinct possibility if you go to Spain today. So the Talmud says that in the areas where the Jews were originally exiled, and maybe it's possible to put on the first slide. The area where they were first exiled is described. You had it before on page 8. This is on note 4. And note 2. The Talmud describes these areas as being part of the Assyrian Empire. In this general area, was the original exile. And it names the cities. And the cities are all cities that are mentioned on different occasions in the Talmud. They're places that they were aware of. And they were wondering, you know, there may be people identified as non-Jews in that area, or really descendants of those original Jews. And it's for that reason that Rav Asi maintains that if a non-Jew gives Kedushin, creates the marriage ceremony to a Jewish woman, one has to be concerned. Maybe it is valid. Because maybe that non-Jew is really Jewish. Shmuel, his contemporary, took issue with this and maintained, of course, that in order to be considered a Jew, one would have to have a Jewish mother. Maintained the only Jewish women who had relations with non-Jewish men were only those who were taken captives. And they were in such poor physical state that they did not bear children. And he maintained historically that those who identified as non-Jews were in truth, were only non-Jews. Because any Jew that had intermarried generally would have married a non-Jewish woman, and their children would not be Jewish. There's an interesting Gemara, though, in Kedushin, an Ayin Beis, that deals with a different scenario. It deals with the possibility, we say, of non-Jews who are actually Jews. There they deal with the possibility of Jews who are descendants of that marriage between of Jewish women and non-Jewish men. And if there is any ramification in halacha about these people. In other words, they look to those who identified as Jews as descendants of this mixed marriage. So at least the possibility of some level of intermarriage is discussed. But on the other hand, the idea of unification seems also to be a distinct possibility. We have record, at least on the three occasions, that the Jews of the Northern Kingdom merge with the Jews of the Southern Kingdom. And this is on your notes on page 10. This is on B, the first note. In the reign of Asa, which he went to war with the Northern Kingdom, during his reign, there were those from the other tribes who merged with the Southern Kingdom and went down to live with them. Early on, when Yeruvim introduced his changes in worship, the Levium, the Levites that were living in the Northern Kingdom, en masse went south. Later, at the fall of the Northern Kingdom, as you said in note 2, there were many who came down south to seek sanctuary by Chizkiyo, the king of Yehuda. And according to the Medrash, there's a Medrash Yalkut Shimoni, the figure that they quote is 1/8 of the populace went south. Furthermore, at the time, much late, 100 years past these events, the Talmud describes, at least according to the version of Rabbi Yochanan, that Jeremiah the prophet went to these lands, convinced many of the people to come back and resettle. And they resettled in their original homelands. And the king of Judea, who was Josiah, was their king. It seems eventually when the Babylonians, the Chaldeans came, captured the southern kingdom, took these people with them as well in captivity. To the extent that there's a Gemara in Brachos and Tezayin Amud Beis, this says that we don't know today which tribe we come from. Are we from Reuven, from Shimon? We don't know what tribe. Is the matriarch from, is it from Rachel? Or is it Leah? We have no idea. One interesting indicator, though, is there's a Gemara in Pesachim, in Dalar Amud Aleph, that says if you see a person who is very litigious, in other words, he's always says, he wants a dintera, anything, says, we'll take it to court. It's a good sign he's from the Shevet Dun. He's from... And if you find somebody who loves the sea and describes in beautiful terms of having their homes by the sea, there's a good chance they're from Zvulun, who live by the sea. But there's another interesting body of literature which strongly indicates the idea of isolation as well. And really it boils down to the definition of what were those areas. The Talmud, we says, defines them as well-known areas. The Medrash, though, seems to describe some of these areas as beyond the pale. And they describe, and you have your notes on page 11, about being exiled to Nahar Sambatyan, the river Sambatyan. The Ramban identifies this Sambatyan. This is the river that rests on Shabbos, that throws out, according to the Medrash, it throws out stones throughout the whole week, that it makes it impassable. There's people from outside can't go in, the inside can't go out. And only on Shabbos does it stop, where on Shabbos they don't have the possibility of going across. And he defines this as Nahar Gozan, one of the places. There's a Targum that describes another one of those places. So the area which is described as Hora, this he had in note 2 on page 8, as Hori HaChoshech, the mountains of darkness. Evidently some inaccessible area. And the Midrashim speak about the Jews in these areas that will eventually return at the time of Mashiach. And will be prodded by the other Jews who will come to bring them back. There is an addition. The Medrash deals not just with the 10 tribes, with the B'nai Moshe, the descendants of Moses, who according to one source, as the Gemara in Brachos and Daf Zayin, that there were 600,000 of them. And they went down with the original exile from Babylon, because we said the Levites lived in the southern kingdom, and were transferred beyond, within the boundaries of the Sambatyan River, you have on page 12. Where these places are, where is the Sambatyan located, has been the object of search for many years. And fascinating stories. One very interesting story that not only is interesting from a curiosity's point of view, but really is dealt with in the area of halacha, is the fascinating story of Eldad Hadoni. There was this fellow Eldad who first seemed to have emerged in Babylon, then came to North Africa, to the city of Kairouan, which was now is in Tunisia, which was a major Jewish center. And finally, he traveled to Spain. He came with a fascinating story. He claimed he was from the tribe of Dun. And he lived in the area of Kush, of Ethiopia. And according to his story, which we have no midrashim on, when Yeravam introduced the worship of the golden calves, and Yeravam was eager to go to war against the southern kingdom, the members of the tribe of Dan felt their place was no longer in Eretz Yisrael, and they decided to leave. And they left, they traveled, they took the land route, went through Egypt. They had an armed guard. The Egyptians had soldiers on both sides of them to make sure that they didn't do anything. And they went all the way down until they came to Ethiopia, to Kush. Later on, according to Eldad, after the 10 tribes were exiled, the tribes of Asher, Gad and Naphtali, these were the children of the maidservants, who were exiled together with the tribe of Yisachar. And they had a sense of inferiority. So they also moved. Neighborhoods keep on changing. And they moved, as we're going to explain, from this area around here, and they took the trip, and they made their way down again to Ethiopia. As Eldad described it, in Ethiopia there were 4 tribes, and they were constantly at war with their neighbors. Each tribe had a conscription of 3 months that they had to fight on the frontiers. And in fact, it's interesting that he describes descendants of Samson, of Shimshon, from with his wife Delilah, which we have no record of. They were fierce warriors. And they took turns every 3 months. And that's where he lived. And he was taking a boat trip with someone from Usher. When the boat capsized, he and his friend from the tribe of Usher were saved. They held on to the ship had fallen apart, and they held on to some piece of the boat. And they finally arrived on dry land when they were met by an insurance issue. I mean, they were met by cannibals. He was taken, his friend from Usher was immediately slaughtered and eaten. He was a little thin, and they started to fatten him up. He did not have a great appetite. And all the food that was given to him, somehow he was able to hide it and only eat just a little bit to barely survive. And when asked what he said, "I ate it all, but I'm just not gaining weight." His captors were finally set upon. They were attacked by another group that killed the whole encampment of these cannibals, and they took him captive. They were fire worshippers. No, they didn't use them for the fuel. No. They finally worked themselves down to an area he calls Atzitz, where he was redeemed by someone from the tribe of Yisachar for 32 gold pieces. And he was taken back to the homeland of this friend from Yisachar, who was, according to his description, was living on the south of Persia. That's below where our area is on the map. And that's where the tribe of Yisachar lived. Above him, above the tribe of Yisachar, lived the tribe of Zebulun. And their area bordered all the way to the Euphrates. According to his version, the tribes of Ephraim and half of Manasseh were living in the Arabian Peninsula, not far from Mecca. We do know of a record of wild Bedouin Jewish tribes. And there have been persistent reports even after the time that Islam was introduced as a national religion, that these tribes still existed. According to him, these tribes were from these 10 tribes. And finally, this is half of Manasseh, and Shimon lived in the area near Crimea, near the areas of what was at that time the areas of Khazars. This is the theme of the book of the Khuzari. They lived in this area here, near the Black Sea. This was his story. And not only did he tell us what a wonderful story, he had told us of their diverse way of life. That their laws, especially we have a record of their laws of Shechita, were somehow different than ours. Very similar, but there were some differences. In fact, these differences are discussed in Halacha. Do they have any validity? Those who learn Talmud, the beginning Tosfos in Chulin deals with one of the problems. He maintained that a woman is not kosher. This was their tradition to slaughter. Tosfos brings down from our Talmud that they are. There's another thing which is brought that he brings, that if a bracha, a blessing, is not said by the Shechita, according to Eldad, it renders it invalid. According to our tradition, it doesn't. You just miss the bracha, the shechita, the slaughtering is kosher. In bringing these various halachas and the story of Eldad, the Mordechai, who was a disciple of the Rambam Rutenberg, the famous mayor of Rutenberg, echoed the feelings of his Rebbe that the whole story is a fake. Great imagination, but totally unreliable. But that was not universally held. In fact, the Jews of Kairouan were perplexed with this man and asked a question to Rav Tzemach Gaon, who was the leader of Jewry in Mesopotamia. This is the site of the yeshiva. He was the Rosh Yeshiva in Pompadisa. What to do with this person? What's his status? And he maintained there's much basis for what he says. Maybe some of it is corrupted, but there's still much basis for what he says. Others, of course, didn't take such a charitable view. The Ibn Ezra maintained it's totally unreliable. But oddly enough, this is the basis. His story has become the basis to a great measure of how we deal with Ethiopian Jewry today. The Radvaz, who was the chief rabbi of Egypt in the early 16th century, had various questions put to him about the dealings in terms of marriage with captive Ethiopian women who claim they are Jews. And basing himself on the story of Eldad, maintained that they are actually descendants from the tribe of Dan, and they are in fact Jews. And this has the acceptance of this story has a great makes great difference as to how we deal with the community. According to Eldad's version, the people in these areas speak Lashon Kodesh. They speak perfect Hebrew. Maybe the dialect is slightly different, but the language they speak is Hebrew. The community, the Beit Yisrael community, does not speak Hebrew. The language they speak is Amharic, which is the language of the area. And their writings are not in Hebrew either. They're sacred writings. They're in Ge'ez, which is the ancient Ethiopian language. And their version of the Torah is not our version either. It's not the Masoretic version, but it's the version that the Christians use, based on the Septuagint. In the 4th century of the Common Era, there were 7 monks from Syria who came to convert the people in Ethiopia. And they provided a translation of the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Torah, into Ge'ez. That is basically what they are using today. This is an alternate of that, which was the common of the Christian version. As far as from the writings, I don't know what today, but of the missionaries who came to visit them, it seems that they themselves did not have a tradition that they came from Don. Even though this is the story of Eldad Adoni. They have a very interesting tradition, which is very similar to the tradition that Ethiopians as a whole have. According to their tradition, the Queen of Sheba, Malchus Sheba, was an Ethiopian queen. She came to Solomon. She had marital relations with Solomon, which is not recorded, at least in our tradition, even though there may be some allusion to it in Midrashic sources. They had a son by the name of Menelik. He became the founder of the Ethiopian dynasty. Menelik came down, according to the story, with other Jews to settle in Ethiopia. The Ethiopian Jews are descendants of either Menelik or the Jews that came with him. Different story. The story of Menelik is part of the national, we'll call the mythology of Ethiopia. Haile Selassie claimed he was a descendant, a direct descendant of Solomon of Shlomo HaMelech. How are we to look at these people? For me personally, it's very hard to believe the story of Eldad Adoni. Historically, even though we do know of a community in Ethiopia, the idea of tribes that maintain, have this tribal identification as Jews, keeping the Torah, not part of Jewry as a whole, is something we don't have much confirmation from other sources besides Eldad. There are repeated stories. The Kurds, there's a Jewish community in Kurdistan, in northern Iran, who claim they're descendants of the 10 tribes. It's a possibility. The Afghanis, the Pathans, which is the major Afghan tribe, claim to be descendants of the ten tribes. There are amongst them, also amongst people in the area, the Nestorian Christians that light candles Friday night, have certain Jewish customs. There's a story that's told over, this is told by a member of the Afghani Jewish community. When he was a young man, I think Michael Goa, he, with a member of the official member of the Jewish community, met the king of Afghanistan. And the king asked the Jew, what tribe do you come from? And the Jew tried to explain to him that we don't know the tribal origins any longer. Unfortunately, because of the Golas, because of the persecutions, and we haven't kept track. So he said, well, if that's the case, I have one better than you. Because I have a yichus brief. In other words, I have a clear genealogy all the way back to King Saul. And he showed it to him, or at least what his version of it was. But beyond that, the stories that crop up, the clear vision of areas of Jews who keep their Jewishness and their tribal identification as something besides his testimony, we have nothing to confirm. What becomes very disconcerting with the Ethiopian community, besides the fact is that they don't speak the language, and they don't have the original Torah, is the fact that virtually they're indistinguishable from their neighbors. There's a Mishnah in the second chapter of Nagoyim that describes what color Jews have. What's the skin of Jews? And it's a light brown. Jews that of course is the there's a Gemara in Pesachim and Pezaino and Bez. This is part of what we went into Golus, was to gather Gerim, was to gather those unusual people that would combine to the corpus of Jewry. But that of course is done according to certain halacha guidelines. One can't just declare themselves to be a Jew. One can't declare themselves to be an American citizen, one has to go through a citizenship process. There have recently been genetic studies done with the Ethiopian the community of Beth Yisrael. And in many that they can, with the genetic studies, it seems that they are in certain areas much closer to their African neighbors than they are to Jews. Iraqi Jews, Moroccan Jews, Polish Jews, Russian Jews are very, very close genetically. These don't have that proximity, don't have that closeness. And it would seem that either they were these people, it would seem that there originally was some body of Jewry that they attached themselves to. But the question was their conversion done al pi halacha? They don't, at this time, don't have the halacha. They don't have the Torah Shabbat Peh. They don't have the oral law. Was it done through some sort of intermarriage? They've disallowed, there is no intermarriage today, but perhaps 500 or 1,000 years ago, perhaps the standards were different. And this is really part of the problems that the chief rabbinate today is grappling with. At the next session, we'll deal, as it relates to the community of Samaritans. There's also a fascinating community we'll discuss next time about the problem of intermarriage. I would just like, last minute or two, just to describe the modern search for the Ten Tribes. There's a fascinating book. It was written around the turn of the century of a Jew who lived in Yerushalayim. With the sanction of the chief rabbinate of the great Rabbonim in Yerushalayim at the time, went for a search for the Ten Tribes. The name of the sefer is Kol Mavaser. It was written by Shimon Tzvi Horvitz. Needless to say, he didn't find them. But It was interesting where he looked. One of the theories he went by was that the river Gozen, which is equated with the Sambatyon, he maintained was some branch of the Ganges. So he tried, it's interesting, the story is interesting, he didn't find it, but the stories are fascinating. One of the stories that he comes up with, it was a fascinating story, and it's described in two areas, of Arab traders bringing rocks in a bowl. And the rocks are tumbling, are moving, are in vibration all 6 days, and on Shabbos they stop. And they claim that these rocks came from the banks of the Sambatyan. Another very interesting story, and on that we'll stop and we'll leave just a few minutes for questions, was the story of Menashe ben Yisrael, who was one of the chief rabbis of Amsterdam, published, was a story of a Murano who came to South America and met Indians. His impression were they were remnants of the 10 tribes. And this was the source that the story began. Of course, the Mormons believe this, so that's the basis of their belief. But the Indians are descendants of the 10 tribes. Again, there's no record of this linguistically. Basically, there is no, they come from another source. However, there may be some merit to it. And this is not, and perhaps this will be even for another lecture. In Bristol, Maine, there's a rock outside the harbor. It's written in three languages. One of them is ancient Carthaginian. We are the traders from Tarshish. They were Phoenician traders that evidently landed on these shores. In Davenport, Iowa, it was known as the Davenport Stella. It was a burial ground there. Near Dameron, they found a stone that's in three languages. One of them is Egyptian hieroglyphics. The style of it is from the 18th dynasty in Egypt. Again, this was a burial thing of this people who had died. There was a marine biologist, a lecturer in Harvard, named Barry Feller, who wrote a book called America B.C., and describes what he maintains are the remnants of these traders who came to America and left signs that they were here. Now is not the time to deal with the book. This was a hobby of his to deal with this, and as a result he wrote this book. But it's quite possible amongst the various traders who came were Jews. Thor Heyerdahl wrote a book called, he wrote Ra 2, which he found that the riverboats on Lake Titicaca in Peru were similar to the riverboats on the Nile. And he claimed that people from Africa made the trip. And he built such a boat, and he made the trip. But that's the subject of another lecture. Are there any questions? Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Whether or not the Ethiopian.
Yeah. The question is as such. The crux of the problem is such. If someone is not Jewish, the practice of Judaism per se does not make one Jewish. One would have to go. It's just like being a good. Acting like a good American citizen doesn't make one an American unless one files for. And if you don't get a green card, you really have gehakta tzaris. You know, but the so acting like a Jew does not make one a Jew. We're not dealing with we're not making value judgments as a human being, but just dealing with being a Jew or not, that by itself would not make one a Jew. One would have to undergo a valid conversion process, and that is the question. Did they or didn't they, especially in the light that one becomes a convert, one has to make a commitment to observe halacha. And if what they are doing is not halacha, then it calls into the question the whole commitment of being Jewish.
I mean, that really is the crux of the problem.
If they're like a third generation, they thought that their family and their mother
were Jews. That still wouldn't make them Jews. We're not dealing now with candidates for conversion down the road. We're dealing with them, are they Jews now? And that really is the problem, which is, again, it's not, in an era of political correctness, it's not politically correct to say anything bad about them. But, and we're not going to say anything bad, but from a historical perspective, this is no DMS. Yes. He came in the year 880. To, right, in the period of the Gaonim. Any more questions? Yeah.
What is the status of artists being created? Are they still born?
Yeah. For the most part, I mean, for all the purposes, we have no questions about the Kohanim and Levim. I mean, in the Talmud it says, when it goes beyond that, no clear genealogy records were kept of the other tribes, I mean, for the most part. And as the Talmud says, we ourselves don't know which tribe we come from, except maybe rare cases. Yeah. No questions. Yeah. It's a Sifri in Parsha Zoyis HaBrocha. And it's a Yalkut Shimoni. It's based on interpretation of the blessing, Bohemia Nagach Apsei Oretz. You will the horns of the tribes of Joseph, which refers, according to the Medrash, according to Yeshua, will gore those which come from the ends of the earth. And based on that, they explain that the armies they were fighting with were not just local Canaanites. You're just asking is, why is it that it became forgotten?
Right.
I mean, that's basically what you're asking. One could only speculate. It could very well be that when they were landed, and each one lived in the area which was the ancestral home, it was important for legal reasons to know which tribe you're coming from in terms of inheritance. So one could claim a certain piece of land, one would be on the basis, well, I'm the son of this one, the son of this one, the son of this one. When it came around the Second Temple period, where they lived in a much reduced area, where they didn't live necessarily in their ancestral homes anymore. So it really didn't have that. There was no necessity anymore. It's perhaps, I'm only speculating, for that reason it fell into disuse. Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah.
I'm gathering it wrong, but when you said during the wandering, they didn't stay as a whole group, but people would drop off and form different communities along the way.
When they came to land and conquered the land, each tribe was given a specific area, and each individual was given a specific area, and they were given they were deeded property. And during the whole time until the conquest, when they were conquered by first the Assyrians and then the Babylonians, each person had their tract of land and knew it. So they had a specific areas at that time. It would seem from a genetic point of view that there was at least to a certain degree some level of would be intermarriage or conversion on some minimal level. Genetically, again, you see that there's a great affinity between even Moroccan or Iraqi Jews and Russian and Polish Jews. But to at least to some degree, a skin coloring, even though it must have some dominance. There's another theory, which is not accepted, at least in present-day genetic theory, that somehow this skin coloring would change, or at least now it would change by being in those environs. We know the Boers, the descendants of those Dutch who settled in South Africa, are as white as their, you know, their cousins, and it hasn't changed them. So what's understood today in the scientific community genetically, we wouldn't understand it that they underwent just automatically a change in color. What the reason is would be speculative. But in any case, being a community that was controlled by halacha, any converts or any intermarriage would go through the process of halachic intervention, so to speak, and what would be accepted or not accepted according to halacha would be the guidelines of that community.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.